Hello, Martin.
Hello, Frank.
We are trying to record this podcast for a second time after some audio and technical difficulties. So that's how committed we are to getting this out for our dear devoted listeners and readers. We're going to try this one again. How's your weekend going?
Pretty good. The interesting test in this conversation is whether it's actually going to be second better than the first one, or if we learn nothing from our mistakes.
Well, there's always a tension, right? I mean, because you learn a bit from your mistakes, but then you also like brush over some of the interesting stuff because you kind of, it's boring now on a second time around. Fortunately, though, I will say that I am, as listeners can probably attest, I am recovering from a cold and I'm sounding better than I was last time. But fortunately, I was so in such a foggy state last time, I really have no idea what we talked about. So I'm going to be coming at this, you know, like an amnesiac patient or something. So.
Well, this will be interesting then.
It should be better.
So we should say that we're taping this on Sunday, October 18th.
That's right.
We're minutes away from Seahawks kickoff, although I will not be watching the game.
You have put yourself on football hiatus.
I have put myself on football hiatus. Are you going to watch the Seahawks when we
I
get
will,
off this?
Yes, I will go back and watch the rest of the game once.
So I'm the only football-hitting hipster.
I am actually, as I was sitting around the other day, and you know everybody's kind of going nuts on Friday, getting ready for the game. I'm kind of excited to be done with the Seahawks. I mean, I know it's kind of heresy in this town, but like, I was never a huge football fan and I'm still not a huge football fan, but you know, my wife's a big football fan. We watch whatever. It's fun. It's fun when the whole city kind of rallies around it, but I don't know. I'd rather the Mariners were good, to be honest.
Yeah. It kind of gets to the point where, I second your notion about the Mariners, and I'm actually much more excited about NLCS game three tonight, game two rather. But I think there's a certain point on Blue Friday when you're looking around at somebody, you're like, you're not a football fan. You're just being stylish, which I guess is okay. Yeah. But
no, it's fair enough.
As someone who used to be really, really into football, it grates a little bit.
Right. You were there when. We should do a podcast. We should talk about stuff that's related to transit and transportation. Unfortunately, there's no, fortunately, there's no new stadium news or anything to talk about related to the intersection of sports and transit, which is always fun when we get.
There's a little bit of news about Key Arena, which we could talk about.
Oh yeah,
yeah. We didn't talk about this in a rehearsal.
No. What happened?
Well, the city came out with a study of what it would take to make Key Arena an economically viable NBA or NHL venue. Mm-hmm. And the upshot of it, I haven't read it or anything, but the upshot is that it would cost $200 and something million, which is much, much less than a new arena.
Sure.
And may transform the economics of all the groups trying to bring some sort of team to Seattle. Now, Sally Bagshaw said something interesting. It was actually very... very transit related. That Key Arena is great, but it really only works if Sound Transit 3 passes, and then you have that light rail station underneath it. Because I was reading a news report again. I haven't read the study, but apparently, like Lower Queen Anne is actually doing pretty well, and maybe doesn't need revitalization or what have you. And you can certainly imagine people not being in love with just a traffic Armageddon every Tuesday night or whatever.
No, I agree. I mean, I used to live at the top of Queen Anne Hill, and I'd always have a bookmark on my phone of when there was a game, because it was just like, don't go down the hill, go the other way, go anywhere but the bottom of the hill. You know, it is paralyzing in that neighborhood for sure.
So yeah, I mean, certainly with Link, or you know, even if the city ever gets this monorail thing worked out where you can use Orca, I think that would really make a pretty big difference to something like that working, and it'd be cheaper in the long run. Yeah.
But did they look at that in the beginning, and then they decided it wasn't feasible, or just they wanted a new arena, or there was that whole thing where we didn't want to spend the money. There was a citizens initiative, and we decided we didn't want to spend the money on Key Arena, and then the Sonics left, right?
Yeah, I get confused on timeline, so I'm not going to embarrass myself by getting this wrong. But Key Arena was designed to be. Was designed to specifically not accommodate hockey, and also was designed to be fairly small. And I think Greg Nichols put it once is that, you know, modern arenas, they have all these food options and like restaurants attached to them that are open all the time and all these other things. Mm. And as he put it, and this is true, like all that stuff exists at Key Arena, right? I mean, the whole Lower Queen and neighborhood has really nice restaurants and bars. It's just not owned and operated by the NBA.
Right.
So, right. You know, I mean, I presume that this study reflects a lot of those realities and what the leagues expect out of arenas these days.
Right.
Because $200 million is probably a lot just to like repaint the thing. I think it's really expanding the footprint and doing some other stuff. But
I'm sure they want more luxury boxes. They always want more luxury boxes.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about, speaking of Greg Nichols, I guess, because he's an elected official. Let's talk a little bit about was an elected official. That's right. Talk a little bit about elections. It's election season coming up, and we've got our endorsements this week. So we should probably talk about who we endorsed and who you endorsed on the editorial board and why you endorsed. Maybe a little bit of background for folks who haven't been paying attention to the finer details, but our editorial board is made up of yourself and Erica Barnett.
Yes.
Zach Shaner and Dan Ryan, also contributors to the blog, separate from our board of directors, which I sit on, and I don't actually participate in the editorial endorsements. So when they came out this week, I read them basically just as soon as all the rest of the readers read them, and I was like, oh, huh, interesting. Now I know who I'm going to vote for. We do try to keep a little bit of a, I don't know if it's a church and state wall, but like a little bit of a separation there, right?
Well, I mean, we've been able to recently. So, I mean, until this endorsement cycle, the board of directors was the editorial board.
That's right. Yeah.
Because the board of directors is meant to be the people who, you know, contribute the most to the organization as volunteers. That usually means writing. And if you're writing a lot, then you're staying on top of the issues and you really kind of have the right and the ability to work on this stuff. But as we've changed our organization a lot with hiring Zach and so on, that really has changed. Because Zach obviously is, by definition, is not much of a volunteer contributor anymore. He's a paid contributor, so he's not on the board of directors. But obviously, he's terribly well equipped to participate in editorial process. And then you have Erica, who writes some great pieces for the blog, but not in enormous volume, and is probably more informed than really anyone in Seattle on all these city council races. Mm-hmm. And then lastly, Dan, who's been really on top of what's going on the East Side in a way that we haven't had since Sherwin and Adam were writing out a ton in their heyday.
Right.
I think it's a good mix, and endorsements actually are a huge amount of work.
Right.
And so it's good to maybe spread the burden a little bit and try to tack yet another do out onto our board of directors.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you have people who, I mean, like myself, I pay attention to what's going on in local politics. I'm not as wired in as some people, and really, for some reason, enjoy collecting checks from advertisers, and so choose to participate in that way because I'm strange.
But to be clear, the board of directors does still direct the organization, and it does select the editorial board if they're willing to serve. And so, the people who've been in charge are still in charge. They're just delegating a little bit.
Right. Right. Yes. Exactly. There hasn't been a coup.
No.
over at Seattle Transit Blog. So let's talk about the races. We've got, so I guess there was, you did a post on, the editorial board did a post on suburban races and one on races in the city, and then on a couple of issues otherwise. So what's most interesting? I mean, I kind of maybe think about taking the city stuff first. We did a set of endorsements in the primary. This wasn't too different from the primary. There was a couple of surprises, I guess, or not a couple of surprises, but there's some new endorsements, I guess, in District 1, West Seattle, District 3, Capitol Hill, and then District 5, North Seattle. So let's talk about those.
Okay, we might as well go in numerical order. So District 1, we had no endorsement in the primary round. We actually interviewed, I want to say, 17 candidates out of 47 in the primary cycle. We filtered out
For the city council races.
Yes. And we filtered out candidates who were clear no-hopers and some others that we knew would never get our endorsement and just didn't want to waste everybody's time. I thought we did a pretty good job of calling that down. I might have, in retrospect, that we might have made a few switches. But regardless, you know, we covered a fair amount of that waterfront. And anyway, in District 1, we interviewed three candidates. Lisa Herbold, Shannon Braddock, and Brittany...
Brianna Thomas.
Yeah. That's not Brittany. No. Gosh. Okay, yes, Brianna Thomas. And at the time, I mean, you were there for this because you were still on the editorial board, but we were a little bit... walking in, we thought that Lisa Herbold probably had the longest shot to get our endorsement because she's comes off as pretty skeptical of market rate development. And as it turned out, we kind of got split a little bit between Thomas and Braddock. Neither of them just blew us away by any means. And so we ended up with no endorsement. We really couldn't settle on something. And, you know, we kept going back and forth. And, you know, you would persuade me of this, then I would persuade you of that. And we'd say, what about this? And after a while, we said, you know, there's no one here that's just so great that we need to endorse. Well, I mean, now that Brianna Thomas hasn't advanced to the general, I mean, now we just have Braddock against Herbold. And, you know, Shannon Braddock, again, I'd hope for a little bit more, but I mean, at the end of the day, she's part of that Dow Constantine Ed Murray block that I think collectively we believe is doing a really great job at moving the ball forward on land use and on transit, and we would like to shore up that block. I think she's has pretty mainstream views in that respect for Seattle politics.
Certainly for West Seattle politics.
Yeah, certainly for West Seattle politics. Lisa Herbold is you know, she I think she's smart and she's committed, and you know. She wrote a guest post for us about, or I guess a rebuttal of something I said, where she really defended the decision not to allow duplexes and triplexes in single family zones. And, you know, I obviously didn't agree with the piece, and I wrote a rebuttal to her rebuttal, which you can find on the blog pretty easily. But, you know, in her defense, I mean, I don't want to beat up on her too much. I mean, her reasoning is basically that tearing down old single-family homes will displace people, and that's a lot better than what you know the justifications that Ed Murray and Tim Burgess and Michael Bryan gave. I mean, Michael Bryan basically said, you know, craftsmen's are beautiful and we shouldn't tear them down. I mean, it's elevating aesthetic preference at this point.
That's like Rasmussen territory.
Yeah,
you'd have neighborhood character districts.
And I don't mean to bash O'Brien either. I still think that Michael Bryan is one of our better council members, and Tim Burgess is on our issues possibly the best. So, you know, I don't think that precludes anything, but yeah, I mean, it's, you know, these council races, the differences are really, really small.
Yeah.
And I think that I think I trust Shannon Braddock a little bit more to do stuff that I would agree with.
Mm-hmm. And I would kind of second that. I mean, I found myself very impressed with both candidates. I was very impressed with Lisa Herbold. I mean, obviously somebody who's been working in city council for a long time for Nick Licata and super well-versed on the issues. Somebody that, you know, 99 times out of 100, I'm probably going to be on the same side of her as an issue I think it'd be good for the city to have that, have her presence. But you know, we're talking about splitting the difference between what's actually going to be best for transit, land use, and you know, as you always say, it's a lot of times it comes down to making transit work better. Comes down to number of units. Comes down to housing density. Comes to things around, you know, how you think about upzoning and those sorts of things.
Yeah, and you know, one other thing is, Herbold really wasn't interesting in separating herself from Nick Licata at all.
Right.
And you know, I think there's reasons to be a little concerned. I mean, I think Nick Licata has a pretty high threshold of skepticism for rail. I mean, we aren't, as a board, like a huge set of streetcar boosters by any means. But, but you know, I think we're more enthusiastic about them, especially something like the Center City Connector, than Nick Licata is.
Right. That's for sure. Let's talk about District 3 then. District 3 was a bit of an about face for you guys on the board. It was a Banks endorsement first time around, then switching over to a Sawant endorsement. How did Banks lose the endorsement, and then how did Sawant gain it?
Well, yeah, so actually there was a forum maybe 2 weeks ago that Erica moderated, and when she got home from that, she emailed us all and said, guys, we have to flip this. And she was right. What happened in this was Pamela Banks was very, very skeptical about Move Seattle, said we really need to take this whole project list and take it back to the neighborhoods and do this sort of balkanized planning, and was negative about road diets and all these other things. And, you know, that was not her attitude in the primary. And that doesn't mean that she's, you know, was dishonest with us or anything. I mean, positions evolve. You go out and you talk in your district and you find out what people want and you try to represent them. I don't know who she was talking to, but that's probably what happened in this policy evolution, if it's not a purely tactical move. But either way, I mean, Move Seattle is kind of in our wheelhouse. It's the thing you can't really get away with objecting to and getting an endorsement from Seattle Transit Block.
Right.
So that's what really drove us away from that. Mm-hmm. Now, Shamsawant, you know, we've historically, I don't think, well, we've never endorsed Shamsawant before. We didn't endorse when she ran ran against Frank Chop in the House, because at the time, I don't know if she still is, but at the time she was opposed to tolling. When she ran against Richard Conlon, we just really loved Richard Conlon. We thought he was a great, great council member on land use in particular. And so that was just a tough opponent for her. But, you know, I mean, obviously the root of our concern about her is not really stylistic or anything. I don't really care if she uses the streets or not to advance her agenda. Her main concern is either a lack of concern or indifference or maybe insufficient concern for market rate development. And, you know, I've always made the point that, I mean, we have to build more housing at all income levels to make the city really work. And she doesn't seem to really be moved at all by the possibility that some of her policies might arrest development. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, we obviously made peace with that in choosing to endorse her. And there were a few reasons. Number one, the centerpiece of her agenda this time around is rent control, and rent control is illegal at the state level. So our general feeling was that was a pretty low risk, like, as much as she might push for that, the odds of that actually happening in the next term or so are pretty slim.
Right.
And so we were going to take that hit. And, you know, we're very much opposed to, I mean, developer taxes are an interesting subject. And, you know, I wrote a piece on Saturday that went up Saturday about kind of different ways of thinking of developer taxes. And, you know, I've responded a little bit to the debate that's gone on other sites between Dan Bertolet and Owen Pickford about linkage fees and do they really deter development and all the other things. And you know, what I've come down on is, yes, they do maybe a little bit. If they get out of control, they're going to be a real problem. But given that this money's being yield housing and the mantra is build more units at all levels,
right,
that makes it kind of not ideal, but certainly something I'm willing to trade for other stuff. So,
yeah, you're getting more units out of the deal, subsidized units, but at the end of the day, the stuff is being diverted to actually get more units built, which is a good thing.
Yeah, so I mean, I'd rather a more general tax rather than one that was specifically on new development. But the point is, you know, I mean, there's, I've heard a reporter say once that, you know, if you cover something long enough, you kind of understand all the arguments well enough that you don't know what to think anymore. And right. I'm not quite at that point, but, you know, I can certainly understand the developer tax position well enough that I don't think it's the end of the world if we put on a linkage fee on something, especially if we get good stuff for it.
Yeah. I mean, I think you have to look at these policies holistically when it comes to housing. It's even things like rent control. Rent control doesn't exist in a vacuum. And I was doing a little bit of, I guess, looking into rent control as kind of this election came up, and I started reading back through some of the literature. Andrew had some good posts on STB from a few years ago about the subject, and reading, kind of getting back into some of the literature. And what you find is that it's really just, it is one piece of a larger issue around housing affordability and housing production. You know, there's different cities in which rent controlled units are only grandfathered from, you know, having been built before a certain year or what have you. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of a way of just like siphoning off the older units and saying, okay, those units are going to be rent controlled. And usually when they say rent controlled, they're not rent frozen in the way they were during World War II. Their rent stabilized, so they only grow with inflation, or the rent can only grow with inflation, and it's set by a government body or whatever. But I think you could make a very easy argument that, in fact, restrictive zoning is a far worse problem than rent control when it comes to the inhibition of new unit production inside a city in the year 2015.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, zoning is public enemy number one, and I would trade anything for a substantial up zone.
Right, especially across the city. I mean, you know, there's an interesting, the Washington Post, actually, Wonk Blog, has been doing some interesting pieces on zoning and affordability. I was going to post something. They did a piece on comparing the different densities of different cities. Did you see this? It kind of went around on Twitter. It was like they would kind of show like this city versus this city, basically trying to make the point that you know, American cities are not that dense compared to, let's say, Hong Kong or something like that, right?
Right.
But the problem was they used they must have been using MSAs or something, because the density numbers were really low, especially for cities that were think should have been high, you know, like New York was about as dense as Seattle, so they, you know, there are
real problems with that. I mean, it's been a couple of years now, but there's a metric called population weighted density,
right?
That I really favor for this kind of thing, because there are problems with just using city limits too.
Right, you can't use city limits. You can't really use urbanized areas. You know, sort of. Yeah, it varies for from. But you're right. The population weighted density is the way to look at it. But
I think that's right. But we just have to get that out to people to start using
the alternative metrics. The other thing that the Washington Post ran a piece not too long ago was just comparing the different unit sizes across various cities. So they said, you know, given 100% of housing, what percentage is zones is single family, what percentage is, you know, duplexes, townhouses, all the way up to multifamily. And what you see when you look at the 20 cities is Seattle has this like skinny waistline where basically a huge chunk of the city is single family and then the rest is kind of, you know, multi-unit apartment buildings, and there's this tiny little waistband in the middle of, you know, townhomes and duplexes, compared to most cities where, you know, older cities where you'd see kind of more stretchy kind of distribution. So it's just, it's interesting the dynamics that we have to work against here, very particular to the city.
Sure. Yeah. And your rent control, like I said, it's a good thing that I don't think that's going to happen, because I think the record of rent control, even when it's sort of mitigated, is not very good in terms of what it, you know, just the perverse incentives it sets up to tear down old housing and do some other things. And worst of all, it's really sticky. Like once you get a class of people into rent-controlled apartments, then you're done. That interest group is never going to give that up.
Right.
And you cannot fix it once you've broken it.
Right. That's right.
Is another problem.
But we're a ways from there.
Yeah.
So that makes a lot of sense then. And I think, do you have anything else you want to add about Sawant?
Well, yeah. So since I've been wailing on her land use and saying, well, I mean, so the reason that we did endorse her is that well, number one, she is a very forceful advocate for building lots of low-income housing units, which is a big part of the problem. And then secondly, you know, on transportation, she's turned out to be okay. Like, there's a certain class of sort of self-described socialists that's like, well, poor people drive, and so we can't have any sort of costs on driving. And as I've mentioned years ago, she was against tolling for that very reason. But she seems to accept, maybe it's just the constituents she has, and the kind of people who are poor in Capitol Hill, they don't drive, right? They ride bikes and they take transit. And she seems to be really open to the safety and the equity arguments that cheaper transportation is cheaper than driving is really good for the city and good for the poor. And if that argument is won the day with her, then we don't have a problem with her transportation policy.
Right. That seems to be the direction which is trending, and is certainly willing to back something like Move Seattle, which is a big transportation levy, and kind of buys into the Murray idea that we can't build more roads in the city, and so we need to find better ways to utilize the existing roads we have, which is all good, which is all too good.
Yeah, so. I mean, it turned out fine. Like, I mean, my biggest fear would be if we ended up in a situation where Seattle had to make route cuts for some reason, which we're not in that position. I mean, King County makes route cuts, but Seattle's basically just buying stuff. So it's what do we get to add? And if Seattle ever had to make cuts, then you would have a situation where, you know, Metro would recommend something that might be more efficient, but you would find the little old lady who's affected negatively by that. And I think that would play poorly with the way that Shama Swant seems to frame most issues.
Right. Although Banks actually gave us the exact wrong answer to that almost exact question in
the
editorial
point.
Meeting. Right.
So in this case, but I'm just saying going forward on transportation, you know, Shama Swant has often complained about the regressivity of transportation taxes, which is a fine point. And I really have no problem with it as long as she realizes in the end that these relatively poor funding tools that we have, using those to do something is better than doing nothing.
Right.
And she seems to have bought, she seems to accept that, which is, so I'm not really concerned with her on transportation at all.
Let's talk about District 5. That was a race where we had endorsed Mercedes Elizan, who did not... We really liked her.
It's Zalde, isn't it? Wasn't there another L in there?
Zalde. Oh, damn it. I shouldn't have said it. I should have looked it up before.
I could be 100% wrong. Yeah. In which case, you know, there you go.
She was a candidate in the 5th District. We really liked her kind of low-income housing. She had some really good ideas on transit and how you invest transit in corridors that are amenable to it. Alas, she did not make it past the primary. And so we were left with Deb Juarez and Sandy Brown. Yes. And we ended up with, I was a little bit surprised based on the conversations that we had had with Juarez and Brown. It seemed like it was kind of going to go in Brown's direction, but then in the end, you guys chose to go with Juarez. What was the difference there?
Yeah, it was tough. We actually interviewed both of them in the primary. And yeah, I came away from those interviews with a really nice feeling about Brown. He seemed really smart and like able to think through transportation problems really carefully. And said some nice things about housing, I suppose. And you know, and actually looking after a couple of days, I realized that there was a bit of a culture clash with Deborah Juarez that wasn't really fair. You know, she to her credit, she said, you know, like, I know you young people, like, you really like don't want to live like my generation does with, you know,
cars and suburbs,
infinite parking and blah blah blah, and like, you know, we really want to be able to use alternative modes of transportation to live more densely, which is what she needed to say. It was the right thing to say, right. But there's a little bit, oh, so you're not one of us kind of reaction
right,
to it. And,
right.
And you know, it took me only a little bit of time to realize that that's what had happened, and once that kind of aura wore off, I realized, you know, it brought Juarez back into play. And she seems, Brown also is really kind of, so I mean, there's basically, to oversimplify, there's two blocks in this council election. There's kind of a Murray block and a Sawant block. Right. And, you know, I think, you know, and having just gone through how we endorse Sawant, I mean, I think we still generally favor the Murray block. And I think Juarez, I don't know how close Juarez is with Ed Murray, but I think Sandy Brown tends to run with a Sawant block.
Mm-hmm.
And that caused a little bit of concern. I think, you know, that was a shockingly strong race. Going in, we thought that District 5 was pretty ripe to have some pretty retrograde stuff in it.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't the case at all. We interviewed another one, Haley Watkins, I think, in District 5. And so that was four candidates we interviewed total, and they were all decent.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, we would endorse any of them in District 3,
right?
As you're saying, which is kind of shocking.
Not what you would have expected with the district system before the before the election. And I want to talk about suburban races in a minute, but before the election actually happens and kind of we see the results, I have to say I'm a little bit surprised how districting shook out, at least this first time around. It was not really what I expected. Having guys like Bill Bradbird running for at-large seats, folks like Sawant, who, you know, I understand that she's developing a base in Capitol Hill, but I could see her with her, she's got the bullhorn to go for an at-large seat. So I find that a little bit interesting. It didn't really stack up the way that, you know, I think a lot of people thought it would. I mean, there don't seem to be a lot of genuine neighborhood folks really kind of, I mean, maybe Bruce Harrell you could kind of say, but he's a guy who won citywide in the past. You know, it doesn't really seem like we're seeing the kind of factionalism that a lot of people predicted when this district-based elections was first announced.
Yeah, I mean, oddly enough, our fear certainly about districting was the map was drawn by people who are maybe part of the neighborhood movement. And so, you know, with any sort of districting arrangements, all about the boundary lines in terms of the policy outcomes you get.
Right. As we know very well on the national level.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, in principle, like representation close to the people is good, but there's this huge asterisk when it comes to that.
That's worth talking about for a little bit for people who haven't been as deep in the weeds. I mean, the district boundaries look very normal. They don't look like the gerrymandered, you know, congressional districts of Pennsylvania or North Carolina after the Republican Party got their hands on them. But they are very much drawn so that, correct me if I'm wrong, but so that single-family homeowners basically compromise a majority of voters in almost every district.
I don't have any numbers at all, but the more qualitative thing that I would say is that you know, if you kind of think of like urban Seattle, which is like Mercer 15th, Mercer like 12th Avenue and Jackson or something like that, you know, like the really dense stuff. Right. U district, what have you. I mean, that's split up among a number of districts. Like, another way to do it would be have one, like, uber urban downtown district, right? Downtown and, like, kind of extended downtown.
Right.
And then have, whereas, you know, Capitol Hill is kind of in District 3 with a bunch of, you know, Madrona Park, yeah. You know, homes.
And then, downtown isn't with Magnolia.
Yeah. I mean, it's
like that. Yeah.
The urbanist worry was that that was going to. Basically, you would have no urbanist districts instead of at least a few. But, you know, I mean, oddly enough, the most unabashedly NIMBY candidate was Bill Bradford. He ran at large.
Right.
And is running at large.
Right.
And, well, I mean, to be fair, you know, I think O'Brien's opponent falls into that category.
Mm-hmm.
But she's just not getting anywhere. Now, O'Brien has tacked a little bit to the right on some of this stuff. So maybe that's, I mean, so the you know, I think the impacts of districting are pretty complicated.
Mm-hmm. And it may take a couple of elections to really.
Yeah. And, you know, and I got to say, like, Michael Bryan has tacked to the right in a very damaging way. I mean, he hasn't just, like, said a bunch of stuff. I mean, he's actually pushed through legislation to trim apartments and basically arrest apartment development in the city.
Mm-hmm.
He's put in a few down zones. You know, it's been really, really. I mean, it's actually hasn't had much effect in who's sitting at the council table, but has actually resulted already, arguably, in legislation that's not very good. I mean, assuming that that's what's driving his conversion. I mean, he probably wouldn't say, "I'm doing this because I'm defending a suburban district."
Well, right. I mean, the other way you could take it is he's saying, "I want to run for mayor in 2017, and I need to widen my coalition." Right.
Well, maybe. I mean, you know. Well, I mean, I doubt that he would phrase it or
no. Of course, he wouldn't say
mercenary terms. And
it could be districts, and it could just be Mike O'Brien's electoral future and him trying to position himself, right?
Yeah, I mean, I really don't want to be, like, really cynical about this. I mean, I think it may be that he genuinely believes that our single-family neighborhoods should be preserved, and that's just something that people hold all kinds of ideas that aren't necessarily part of...
Yeah, it's just...
single ideology.
No, it's hard to see a Sierra Club guy... thinking that way, but I see your point.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the suburbs a little bit. Anything else you want to say about five? I think Juarez is
candidate. That's about it.
So let's talk about the suburbs. We had, I think you guys did a really good job of doing a broad swath of the suburbs this time around, which I was really happy to see. We got a lot of endorsements in Shoreline. We got some stuff in Bellevue. The Bellevue stuff, I don't think anything was super surprising to me, but I think it's interesting that we seem to have some really decent pro-development or pro-growth, pro-transit candidates in Bellevue. Anything else stick out there?
Yeah, I mean, Bellevue is a I mean, Bellevue's getting to be a pretty big city and has a lot of these issues, and they've kind of reached the point where they realize they can't widen their roads anymore, and right. They're going to have to support transit and other alternative transportation modes. So I think, you know... I think really weird local issues have painted the Bellevue Council as more conservative than they actually are.
Hmm.
You know, in particular, you had a light rail line that happened to be running through a single family neighborhood that was just dead set against it. This whole Surrey Downs thing.
Right.
And anytime you have, or Enatai, I guess, well, both of them. Anytime you have like really, really focused neighborhood opposition to a project. That is seeking not to completely destroy the project, but do stuff that maybe isn't optimal from a planning perspective, you're going to find solicitous political leaders at the most local level for that. So
people want to sop up those votes. Well, that's true, but the whole reason Surrey Downs was on the table is that the line kept getting pushed further and further east until it ended up in their lap, right? I mean, there could have been a potential alignment that would have... avoided that neighborhood had Kemper Freeman not been so dead set against, and the city council not, you know, wanted the tunnel, and there was the whole, we don't have enough money for a tunnel, and
all that kind of stuff. Well, I'm not sure. That's true. I'm not sure that I'm not sure it's really all about. I don't think Kemper Freeman didn't really do anything about this. I think it was either a fear that going way west and then through downtown Bellevue would be too expensive. Mm-hmm. They're probably also concerned about running on the surface, which maybe is how you afford that. And that, I mean, those concerns are legitimate. I don't think surface link necessarily is a great idea in Bellevue. I think furthermore, it adds to travel time, which makes Redmond unhappy. And then, yeah, I think there's also some fear that Kemper Freeman would sue more. Mm-hmm. I don't know what more he could do than he's doing.
Well, but
now.
He also got a lot of candidates who were elected to the city council who wanted to push it over to 405. And
sure,
you know,
I mean, that's pretty small beer stuff. I mean, as much of it is a big deal and sort of a implementation in the scale of light rail implementation, that's a big deal. But it's not like a big deal compared to the argument of should we build light rail on the east side or not.
Sure, fair enough.
Yeah, I mean, look, the Bellevue. At the same time, I don't want to make it the Bellevue Council or be Seattle. I mean, their objection, as I understand it, to running on the surface through downtown Bellevue is basically this might possibly impair a car somewhere.
Right.
Not any concern about like speed and reliability of the train.
Right.
So you know, it's a work in progress, but I think now that we're through that issue, I think just sort of Bellevue's gotten pretty much all the light rail it's going to get. I think now we're talking about BRT projects and ST3. We're talking about Bellevue's transit master plan.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, you know, people are okay with it. It's just a question of how much they're willing to raise taxes to do these things, which is kind of a Republican-Democrat thing.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So we have Claudia Balducci is now running for King County Council.
Yes.
Over on the east side. So vying to replace Jane Haig, got her endorsement. She's been very good as the Bellevue mayor.
Yeah, and also on the Sound Transit Board, and she's been working with PSRC, which maybe isn't the favorite organization of our readership, but you know, she's at least keyed into that stuff.
Yay, yeah, regionalism.
I mean, you know, Jane Haig has not been horrible in a lot of respects, but you know, but Balducci's been great in other roles, and I think King County Council she'll be a pretty strong force for Metro stuff.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about Shoreline. We had a couple of interesting endorsements. Shoreline's turning into a bit of a, well, this is a key time for Shoreline, right? I guess you've got the light rail alignments being planned through Linwood Link, and we're talking about where we're going to put the station, and we basically decided where we're going to put the station. Now the question is just going to be how much are we going to allow development in and around the station, and how far is that development going to go? I had a post up this week about 145th Street and the efforts to try to make that a more hospitable feeder street to the light rail line that will theoretically be, well, it looks like it's going to be built there.
Yeah, so actually I wanted to ask you about that because I don't know anything about North 145th Street. Is that wide enough to put in a bus line?
No, it's not wide enough to do anything without taking property. But
okay.
From what I heard listening to the, watching the, they had a presentation from the consultants who did the study. I mean, they're basically putting it out there and saying, like, look, if we want to make this street suck any less, we're going to have to take property. It's a question of how much property would you take and how much of a fight are we going to get from the community if we try to, which strikes me as a interesting starting place to basically be framing the conversation around, look, the right of way here is about 60 feet. And if we want to do anything involving, you know, any kind of pedestrian access or any kind of bus access, we're going to need to go 90 or 100 feet, which means we're going to significantly need to widen the right-of-way. So that seems to be the starting place of the conversation, although you could easily see it getting to a place where they just kind of throw up their hands and don't do anything about it.
Well, wait, 60 feet, that's... How many lane widths is that? Are there four lanes on 145?
There are four lanes.
So, well, so they could put in a bus lane. It's just they don't want to give up.
Well, that includes the sidewalks.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, sorry. I should be clear that that's like the total public right of way is 60 feet, including the sidewalks.
So how many actual lanes of traffic are there on 145th?
There are four. Two east and two west.
Okay.
And then very narrow 3-foot wide sidewalks on either side, right against the street. So
okay. So right. So to do bike and ped stuff, you would have to do something. But in principle, you could get a bus lane, and if they're just willing to not care about car traffic.
Yeah, and there was a discussion of a potential contraflow or reversible bus lane, which is something you could look at. Oh, so there, I mean, you know, there are options they're looking at in those studies that would be a little bit more efficient. And it seems like, you know, people are sort of, you know, there seems like there's an effort there to do something that's not terrible, but it's going to require some significant rethinking of the corridor to get that kind of mobility.
Yeah, I mean, suburban races are interesting because they're hard to do in terms of endorsing in our issues. I mean, so can we look specifically at land use and transit issues, and let me digress for a minute the reason we do that is that while in fact we are all basically left of center people, as you might imagine, people have different issues and different ideas about issues, and you guys have no idea what any of us think about guns or police brutality or lack thereof or crime or what's some other issue that I'm thinking of, or sports arenas or anything else. So like, it's not for our endorsements to be useful, we think that people need to understand what we're basing it on and what values you're basing it on. And you guys only necessarily know our values on those particular issues. So we do that. And we also, you know, try to maintain. I think it's worthwhile to have a narrow issue, have an issue-oriented endorsement process to just kind of encourage action on those issues.
Right. That makes sense given what we care about. It also separates out our endorsements from other people. Because we also have the freedom to not endorse. We're not trying to do a, you know, progressive voter's guide where we have to have a position on every candidate. It's really just saying, here's some candidates who have exceptionally interesting things to say about transit and land use.
Yeah, I mean, especially in legislative races, I mean, because those are, I mean, nonpartisan races, it's always difficult for people to figure out what people think about what. There's not the additional indication you get from a party label. But in legislative races, there is a party label. So we could go through. I mean, look, everybody knows that the average Democrat is better than the average Republican on transit issues. Like, you know, in any given legislative race, you can sort of use that as an easy, if you don't know what to do and you really care about transit, that's an easy thing to do. Mm-hmm. An easy decision to make. Like, us writing that and endorsing a Democrat in 35 or whatever legislative races, you know, where there's not a lot going on, it's not
adding a ton of value.
It's not adding any value. So what we do instead is we try to focus on the six or seven legislators out there who are really making a big difference in transit. At the state level, especially transit and like Amtrak, and not so much land use. But yeah, on our issues, whoever's really doing a great job are the people we have to go and single out. And same thing with these suburban races. I mean, a lot of these small suburban towns, they don't really have the issues that we're talking about. I mean, Maple Valley gets however many buses it does a day. They're not going to put in a bus lane.
Right.
Adding service is a county issue. They're not going to raise taxes to run a bunch of buses. They're not going to put in a bunch of this infrastructure. They might do some bike stuff, which would be nice. Mm-hmm. There's not even really demand for some really dense development either. Development is probably just adding more cul-de-sacs. So it's not very often when you get way out there in the exurbs that there's really anything to cover at all. But, you know, some of these, Bellevue, as I said, is becoming a pretty big city, and it has all the whole set of issues. Some of the other ones too, the ones are getting light rail. I mean, Shoreline is a big one because it's getting two stations, and Seattle didn't get a station it wanted largely because of Shoreline, and Shoreline really needs to do a good job. Mm-hmm. Now, luckily, they are really fired up to do BRT on 145th, which is the right answer to get people in and out from there. We customarily have a call for endorsements early in our process. We put out a post letting people comment, and that's useful for a bunch of things. Number one, you know, obviously the wisdom of crowds. You find a lot of races you maybe would never have noticed, and several of those turned into endorsements for us this time around. And also, it tells us what people are interested in. I mean, there's no point in us writing this if nobody cares. So if somebody says, hey, I'd really like you to look at Port of Seattle, we'll take a look at Port of Seattle. And we did, and we had trouble finding, in this case, any issues that were germane to us at all. But we'll take a look. We looked at Shoreline, and there was a big – I mean, it didn't take long. We looked at some statements, and they were pretty clear. Just looking at the voter's guide – statements, it was pretty clear who had sort of anti-density dog whistles and who didn't. And there was actually some blowback in the comments on this, which was kind of interesting.
Yeah, it seemed like it got some play in Snohomish County or in Shoreline among people who not Snohomish County in Shoreline yeah. among people who actually were familiar enough with the issues somehow found the blog and were fired up to write about it and tell you guys how you don't understand anything about Shoreline politics.
I don't know very much about Shoreline politics. That's certainly the case.
It's an accurate statement.
I think. Well, so I mean, first people said, "Well, you're talking about being, you're saying so and so's anti-transit," which is actually something I definitely did not say. I said that one of the R endorsees was very pro-transit, and then I talked a lot about density, and then it ended up degenerating a little bit. But the basic critique was like, well, yes, this person, the person we didn't endorse that accused of using anti-density dog whistles. They want an up zone, but they don't want this massive oversized up zone, which, you must not be a regular if you think I believe in something called an oversized up zone. There was actually an interesting, argument that common threads aren't good at sustaining arguments like that, but there was an interesting discussion in there that maybe should become a post someday, and about, well, I think the assertion of these commenters was that everyone wants to upzone within a half mile or a quarter to a half mile, which is what, I mean, one would hope so, first of all. Second of all, I mean, it's not clear to me, like, if there's a height difference or what have you. But setting that aside, like, the real problem that people had with the people that we endorse is they wanted to also upzone from the half to 1 mile radius. Right. And there's a couple of things there that are there's a couple of issues I have with that. One was a few things are interesting about it. So number one is like I believe that dense development is good even if the transit the transit access is not very good. That anything sure. is better than this, even if it's just like a bus that that's stuck in traffic that comes every now and then. Like having dense housing and more units and all the things that brings you it's still worth it, even if those people end up driving a lot.
Mm-hmm. Just a better societal good for sprawl and all sorts of things and human society and the general flourishing of the liberal and useful arts to have people bumping into each other in coffee shops.
Exactly. Well, I mean, there's enough rants about how awesome density is that, yes. I mean, it's just, and by the way, density breeds transit service, right. Incidentally. So there's that too. But, it's interesting because I started to appreciate his position a little bit because I said, what's going to happen is, more than a half mile is too far. These people are going to drive to the station and clog up the road so no one can get there. Sitting down here in Seattle, it's like, well, so you're saying like it's going to be too many people are going to try to use the station. I mean, that's great, right? But, when you like, when I try to use a little bit of empathy, it occurred to me, if you're a Shoreline resident, what matters is can you get to the station?
Right.
And if there are a lot of people there who are driving there beside you, then it may be harder for you to get to the station. If the population of Shoreline were to remain static, then obviously there would be less competition for parking spaces at the 145th and 185th Street stations. Which, with the exception of whatever population adds within walking range where there's just no point in parking. So, I think it's worthwhile to understand that and what the issue is there. Now, to me, the answer is not to if those people don't live between a half mile and a mile of the station, where are they going to live? They're going to be out in the sprawl. They're going to drive a very long distance to the station, or they're going to drive all the way into Seattle or do whatever it is they're going to do. That's not good either. The real answer, of course, is to have really good transit service, safe bike routes, and all this other stuff on 145th and 185th, as we were talking about. And then furthermore, to manage demand at the parking garage through charging, as we're a broken record about this.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's about having a kind of relatively uniform, not even uniform, but somewhat more uniform mesh of density supported by a range of transit and alternative forms of infrastructure, and not necessarily seeing these transit stations as kind of this like oasis in a desert, right? Where
exactly.
It's just like, where we and that is a challenge, I think, and that is a general critique that we've had of, I think a lot of people have had of the general approach to light rail of just kind of, you know, well, there's this one station and for 3 miles, there's not going to be any transit in any direction except for this one really expensive light rail station, right? You have to think about it as these cascading nodes of transit, of, you know, bus service and walkability and all these kinds of things. And we have to get out of that mindset. And it's very hard when our transit planners have a way of reinforcing this mindset by putting the station next to the I-5 off ramp, you know, and making it really seem like an extension, basically a really high end HOV lane. Right. And when you set it up like that, it becomes harder to reframe the debate. And so I think that is a challenge of kind of getting people away from thinking of, oh, well, this 145th station, and it's got to be about driving there when I want to drive there to go to work or maybe a Mariners game. And it's more about, you know, there's a level of density, a mesh of density all around shorelines such that at least on major corridors, I can walk to interesting things and drive to things and take a bus to things. And sometimes that bus will connect me to a light rail when I need to get somewhere. Sometimes it won't, you know. But thinking about that cascading set of transit options in a more walkable lifestyle, right?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, that person that lives 3/4 of a mile from the station is going to walk a heck of a lot more than the alternative, even if they do have to drive occasionally,
right?
Because they don't live right that close to the station.
Exactly.
So yeah, I mean, you know, I guess that whole argument just caused me to just reinforce my belief that we were right in our endorsements. but you know, I mean, people obviously are free to support who they want to support and advocate for it. That's great. But I think we were right in what we did, even though we did parachute into that race.
Any other races? We're going a little bit long here. Any other races or kind of issues you want to talk about? Or?
Well, yeah, we looked really hard. We looked fairly hard at Snohomish County Executive. We just couldn't get anywhere on it. We sent a couple questions to Somers and Lovick, the two candidates, and Lovick responded, and his responses were kind of fine and what you would expect from a Snohomish County Executive. You know, light rail via Payne Field to Everett and support the CT measure and some other things. And that was fine. And we're going around a little bit on how they have somewhat different visions for land use, and I might be getting this backwards now, but one of them wanted to focus the development in Everett, and the other wanted to focus in southern Snohomish County. And I'm not going to say which is which, because I'm my brain is mush, I can't remember anymore. But we had an interesting debate, because the initial reaction was, oh, well, you know, this person who wants you to sprawl into Snohomish County, well, that's clearly wrong. We want to do it in Everett, and I said, no, wait a minute, though. Snohomish County is closer to downtown Seattle.
Right.
It's, you know, Linwood is, I mean, I believe that Linwood is among the most serious of all the suburban cities in really making the most of this and densifying and doing all the other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe this is a weird case where, like, the gravitational pull of Seattle is such that it actually makes more sense to densify in Linwood than in Everett.
And Everett's never going to be a huge employment center. It's always going to be a kind of small city, right?
Well, maybe. I mean, I don't know. I can't predict the future. But you know, my objection served enough to muddy the waters. We didn't end up endorsing. So it's another example, just a bunch of work for nothing. Yeah. So I mean, that was, we looked a little bit at Tacoma, and there wasn't a whole lot there either. Just a measure that was fine that we endorsed. But yeah, I mean, we looked at someone asked us to look at the Burien race, Austin Bell and Darla Green. I actually sat down, and V-Town Blog had an hour-long debate that they put on YouTube. And I actually sat down and listened to that while I was doing something else, maybe above and beyond a little bit. And actually, it was kind of curious to really get that deep a dive into issues of a city that I don't know that much about. And, you know, as it turned out, it was pretty clear that Austin Bell was the one that most shared our values, but it was interesting that even just stuff about crime and homelessness and other things that aren't in our subject matter, kind of an interesting little experience to do that.
That is interesting. Yeah, see what's kind of going on out there. All right, well, I think we've gone on long enough here.
Yeah, considerably longer than our rehearsal.
I know, yeah, this is what happens. You kind of spread out a little bit. And well, I'm also less half dead, so I think I had a little bit more to say than I did at 9 o'clock on Friday night when we tried this the first time around. Well, I guess we may or may not do another one of these before the election. We should certainly do one after, once we know who wins and kind of what the upshot is. But This was really helpful. It was really useful for me in understanding. I hope it was interesting for our listeners to get a sense of the not just the work that goes into the endorsement process, but just kind of the behind-the-scenes thinking of how we go about things. So I'm curious to see how we did.
Okay.
In the meantime, I'm going to go see how badly the Seahawks are losing.
Oh, so pessimistic.
I'm telling you, man, I'm just dying to get off this bandwagon.
All right. Enjoy the game.
All right. Thanks. All right. Bye.
Bye.